Right now, I'd like to welcome Natasha Schull. She's a cultural anthropologist, a documentary filmmaker, faculty member at Massachusetts Institute of Technology's program in Science, Technology, and Society. She's the author of the book Machine Life, Control, and Compulsion in Las Vegas. And she's a summer fellow at the School for Advanced Research here in Santa Fe. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
It's great to be here. Thanks.
It's good to have you back. We talked last year, I think, about your book, which had yet to come out. You are an anthropologist who works on this phenomenon of gambling, and particularly compulsive gambling.
Exactly. I've been looking at this subject for almost 15 years now. It started as an undergraduate thesis way back when in Las Vegas, right with the boom of gambling as family entertainment. So that's where it started for me.
And it's gone on from there. I mean, one of the things that is so amazing about gambling is that it used to be kind of a social thing where people would sit around at a table, you know, at home with nickels and dimes or in a casino with whatever, chips or whatever, but it was a social phenomenon. That's mm-hmm. less and less the case.
Absolutely. I mean, we've got so much media hype around live poker in film, and it's being broadcast on the sports network, etc. But if you actually look at the numbers, it's only 3% of gaming revenue that's generated by games like live poker. Really, the vast majority, the lion's share of revenue is coming from machine gambling. So I'd say about 75%. And if you go to areas where local residents are playing, they highly prefer machines. And there you've got almost 90% of revenue from these properties coming from machine gambling. So that's what I chose to look at. This has really been a phenomenon since the 1980s, accelerating to the present day.
And what's so preferable about machines?
Well, it's really a different kind of gambling. I've been this past year, and we'll continue to do so in the coming months, I've been testifying in front of different legislatures who are considering this. And what I'm always struck by the fact that people talk about gambling as if it's one thing, and they talk about compulsive gambling as if it's the same sort of activity, you know, whatever form it's taking, whether you're playing cards, whether you're shooting craps, whether you're at the machines, it's really different beasts. And what's so different about it, the overarching difference, is that you're playing alone by yourself with a machine. There are no people to interrupt you. There are no other people who will change the sort of moderate the pace of the game, the flow of the game. It's really you determining the rhythm and the pace, the speed in front of a machine. So you can really zone out, and that's the word that the gamblers I talk to use.
And they like it.
Well, like is a difficult kind of word. They're definitely drawn to it, let's say. They're drawn to the escape that they find these machines give them. It's really compelling. I guess you could say they like it, but if it becomes too compelling and they start to feel stuck there, like changes to more of a need, and that's where you have the compulsion coming in.
And the machines are designed to really foster that compulsion and that need.
They are. I mean, it's a difficult thing. Journalists in particular this past year have been trying to get me to say that these machines are designed to create addicts or to create compulsion. I actually don't think they're designed to do that. They're designed to increase the bottom line. They're designed to make money. And an effect of that is that they end up catering to the sort of play that sort of escape play that gamblers want, and you have a resulting situation where you've got machines that are more addicting. I'm always careful to say I've met a lot of these designers. A lot of my research is with the designers themselves in their laboratories, at their gaming trade shows, and a lot of them are really nice guys, and they really honestly don't think of their work. They think of it more part of the entertainment business, that they're providing entertainment to consumers, and that consumers have right to their entertainment, and that there's just a sort of small bunch of people who are vulnerable to the addiction. So they really don't connect. They actively attempt to disconnect the sorts of design maneuvers that they program into these machines with addiction.
Are any of them addicted to their own machines?
Well, that was the most fascinating part of the research for me, is that when I finally realized, you know, this project had many, it's gone on for a long time, has many stages, and at a certain point I realized I can't just talk to gamblers about their experience at the machines. I need to go and talk to the people designing the machines, start really getting in and understanding how does a random number generator work? What are these algorithms going on inside the machines? How do they pick the lights, the sounds? And that was really illuminating. And what I didn't expect is just your point that there are actually some designers who themselves have experienced this same kind of zone. I don't know that I'd describe them as gambling addicts. I'm sure they're out there. But there would always be a sort of a point toward the end of our interview when they'd say, you know, it's really funny. Even though I design these machines and I understand all of the math inside these machines, I too sometimes find myself just kind of playing not really to win, just playing to play. And I know what that zone is. So they get it. And that's precisely the point of my work, is that this is a very huge, this idea of a zone where you get absorbed in an activity and sort of stuck there and lose sense of time and space, is actually a very human phenomenon. And, you know, we're all, I think, vulnerable to it under the right circumstances, and it can sometimes be really creative.
Well, and it strikes me when you say that, that it's probably something that's missing from American mainstream culture as something that might be built into other cultures that have trance dances or other types of activity where you go into a trance. Here we have to use a machine.
Right. Certainly as an anthropologist, I could make the argument with the extensive reading I've done in more traditional forms of anthropology that what these machines are catering to is a human tendency to want to be absorbed in a sort of trance-like kind of state. And those, I think it's the same psychophysiological state, and it's a big jargony word, but it's the same sort of psychological and physiological state as people might experience if they're dancing, or some rock climbers talk about going into the zone, or people in trance or other kind of ritual states.
And there's actual brain chemicals.
The machinery. Yeah, there is actual brain chemistry that's modulating this experience, absolutely. I think the difference is, what is the medium of the zone? What is the machinery of the zone in the case of my project? And how is the machinery designed to actually channel the zone in a certain direction? And there's something very different, just to take the example of rock climbing again, between being out in the open on a mountain climbing a rock or being at the gym on a treadmill where you're being channeled in one direction. So the machines, you can kind of think about them like that. It's not a it's not a sort of free-for-all game that you can improvise as you get into the zone. The machine that's responding to you has been programmed to anticipate your responses. It's a very tight feedback loop. That's how I think about it.
And meanwhile, it's extracting money out of your wallet or credit card.
Exactly.
And you're not getting any exercise or having a common experience
exactly.
with other people.
I mean, there's certainly a large overlap in the goals of gamblers, which are to get into the zone, and the gaming industry talks about this as time on device, that's the aim of the players, is to achieve maximum time on device. And that overlaps with the industry's aim, which is to extract maximum revenue. And they have a kind of creepy-sounding word for it, or phrase, which is playing to extinction. And what that means, you know, it doesn't mean they're trying to kill us off, but it does mean they're trying to deplete.
That is pretty scary.
Deplete our funds. It's a psychological technical term that people can sometimes misinterpret. So to Myers, it's not quite so sinister. But playing to extinction, time on device, these sort of overlapping aims. But the gambler really wants to stay in the zone. The industry wants to extract the revenue until the funds are depleted.
And so you, as an anthropologist, are studying this, and I suppose New Mexico is a good place to do that.
New Mexico is a good place to do that. You've got a lot of casinos, as everyone listening to the show knows, and you've also got a situation where these casinos are not primarily getting their revenue from tourists. They're primarily getting their revenue from New Mexicans, from locals, and this is a well-known fact, is that locals prefer machines, and locals are more likely to be what's called repeat gamblers. So they're not kind of coming in with their friends, putting a couple quarters in the machine. They're more likely to return to really, in the industry, they're known as a mature market, a sophisticated market, a market of repeat players.
Amazing. Is there any way to measure how much money is diverted into gambling and what it's diverted away from?
You know, measurements like that are really complicated, difficult to make, and you can sort of statisticians come in and demographers, and they can make arguments in one direction or another. It's a lot more of that kind of research gets funded in Canada, actually, and there's some surprising and frightening studies showing that if you look at the repeat gamblers who are going regularly to the casinos, they are actually contributing a large degree of that revenue. It becomes even more disproportionate when you look at the repeat players. As to where the money's not going, yeah. You know, that really depends on the context. And in the context of Native American gaming, I mean, it's I have a colleague of mine, another anthropologist, who's just written a book. She studied with the Seminole tribe in Florida, and she actually comes out with a pretty positive analysis of what that revenue has done for the maintaining traditional languages, etc., education, other programs. So it's certainly hard to criticize when you're looking at it that way. But I think increasingly, as this is being, you know, just everywhere, this gambling is being turned to as a source of revenue, people are realizing that it comes with problems.
Now, what are the attempts to change the laws all about these days?
Well, the attempts, if you're referring to the legislation, I mean, this is where, in places where they're considering bringing in casinos, and so it has to pass legislature.
Oh, okay.
And, you know, on the pro side, it's always, this would be an incredible boost for our economy, it would provide jobs. People who are pro-gaming are usually able to get a lot of unions on board just because of the job factor, although often then the unions turn the other way once it starts because they realize that the problems that come with it. There are definite studies showing that employees in the gaming industry have a much higher rate of compulsive gambling because they're just around it more, they're exposed to it more, and for whatever reason.
So the unions are in favor of it until it happens, and then they say, oh my goodness, what have we done?
That can happen, yes.
Good heavens. So... what are you actually doing in New Mexico right now?
Here in New Mexico this summer, this is a project that actually occurred to me as I was going around giving testimony. I was in Massachusetts giving testimony, and again, I was struck, people don't really have a sense of who these compulsive gamblers are. It's like this big, people have this stereotype that these are the real lowlifes, the degenerates, or maybe it's the old blue hairs, you know, the old ladies sitting at the machines. In fact, it's just cuts across all of those categories. So in my experience testifying, I saw that the legislatures and, to a large extent, the general public, especially in areas that don't yet have gambling, are really quite ignorant about who are these gamblers are. Who is a compulsive gambler? You know, people have this idea that it's a sort of low-life, degenerate subculture, or blue-haired old ladies in Las Vegas, this kind of thing. In fact, if you look at who's playing the machines, it cuts across all of these kind of stereotypes. Cuts across class, race, sex, etc. And so the goal of this project is to bring gamblers' own words and voices to the public, along with their images. So I was using New Mexico as a kind of pilot site to gather a set of images and a set of narratives of gamblers, again, in their own words, that I would compile and use this to get money to do a study, a book-length project across the country. And then I would imagine this book could be used. The United Farm Workers did something similar, where they could sort of discuss their cause, portray, here are farm families, here are farm workers, here they are in their habitat, here are their words, here are their stories, and a portion of the revenue from the book could be then diverted to the cause. So my idea was that as gambling continues to come up, you know, in different states across the country who are looking to make revenue, and they're actually considering, the legislatures and the public is considering inviting these kind of machine gambling into their towns, into their cities, that they could have a book to say, wow, look at all of these people. Here they are on the page. Here are their faces. Here are their hands. Here are their words. And really get a sense of who this affects.
Now, are you working with a photographer? Are you photographing yourself?
I'm here working with a photographer, and I'm doing the interviews. And it's anonymous in terms of names, because it's really more about the human stories rather than identifying particular people. And I photographed a couple of people who didn't want their faces shown, so I took pictures of their hands, silhouettes, etc. Others are quite happy to kind of be on the record and have their face photographed.
Are you still looking for people?
I am still looking for people, and it would be great if anyone listening to this show was interested in participating about their experiences with these machines. And these don't have to necessarily be people who define themselves as compulsive gamblers. I want a whole range of people. Basically, the book would be talking about how does this machine gambling technology change our experience of the gambling scene and our daily life, actually.
So if there are people who, for example, you know, once a month go and blow $75 or something like that, that's a non-compulsive, non-addicted gambler.
Right, unless they felt somehow that it was compulsive. But in my book, that would be a non-compulsive gambler. But still, I've talked to these people, and they have very interesting kind of insights about what these machines do for them. I mean, it's amazing when you start talking to people and ask them questions like, how do these machines make you feel when you're gambling? Do you think of them as a sort of, as the machine, as its own kind of person? Do you think of it just as a piece of machinery? What sorts, do you have excitement at the machine? Do you zone out at the machine?
Right.
And you realize that people are having very rich kind of encounters and experiences in front of these machines. And that, to me as a cultural anthropologist, that really illuminates the human side of this whole story about gambling, machine gambling, compulsive gambling. And I would like to bring that story to the public and sort of show this. We started out saying this is not a social form of gambling. It's quite asocial and isolating. And because of that, it's a sort of hidden community. It's not, it doesn't
right.
have, it hasn't gained the sort of positive reputation of something like AA and the Alcoholics Anonymous movement.
But there are Gamblers Anonymous.
Absolutely, and that's where I've been going to meet some of the people I've been talking to and photographing. But I'd like to sort of bring together this, what I think of as this kind of hidden community, and show the range, the diversity of people. You know, when I was in Las Vegas, one morning I would be in a trailer park talking to a single mother with four kids, and she would
use...
Who blew the lunch money or the milk money. And later that day, I'd be over in a rich suburb of Summerlin talking to a doctor's wife whose hands were covered with jewelry, and she was blowing all the family savings. Yet they were using... those two very different people on the face of it were using very similar words to describe their encounters and experiences with the machine. So to me, you've got this, I almost think about it, the machines as a kind of homogenizing force. They're homogenizing a shared experience between
right.
very diverse people. So that's the goal of this project. And I would love to have more New Mexican faces and words in this first pilot phase of this book project.
Natasha Schull is a cultural anthropologist and documentary filmmaker, and she teaches at Massachusetts Institute of Technology, is the author of the book Machine Life, Control and Compulsion in Las Vegas, and she's here at the School for Advanced Research. Amazing work. Is it depressing for you doing this year after year?
You know, it definitely has depressing aspects, but one can find certain redemptive threads, and especially talking to these people, they have so much insight. When you actually meet and speak with people who get labeled compulsive gamblers, you realize they're not dupes. They know what's going on. They have a great deal of insight into this problem, and they are usually happy to share that. And the idea that they could expand knowledge, people who haven't yet encountered these machines. And to me, that's really hopeful.
Natasha, thank you so much for being with us on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.